I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Today's program was brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm in Vermont, a producer of award-winning handmade cheese from goat and cow milk. For more information, visit considerbardwellfarm.com.
Hi, this is Celia Cutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more. Hello, this is Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd on heritageradio.org. Today I'm pleased to welcome Michael Paterniti, author of The Telling Room, A Tale of Love, Betrayal, Revenge, and the World's Greatest Piece of Cheese. Welcome, Michael.
Oh, hey, thanks, Diane. Thanks for having me.
You're very, very welcome. It's delightful to have you. You're my first I don't even know how to describe your book. It's so unique and unusual.
I appreciate that.
Being a cheese book interviewer, I don't often get to read books like yours.
Yeah, I feel like in some ways I was not someone who would have even myself predicted that I would have written a book about a piece of cheese. I mean, I love cheese, don't get me wrong, but... Once I got sucked into this story, I couldn't put myself away just in the reporting of it, even.
Uh-huh. Just for our viewers or our listeners who have not read your book, the book combines cheese, Spanish history, slow food philosophy, a family travelogue, and your own personal path to the mystery of this cheese. Would you say that's an accurate description?
Yeah, and the one other part that gripped me from the start was the fact that there was a little murder plot behind all of it. That drew me in deeply. In fact, to go to the beginning of the story, I mean, this whole thing started when I was a grad student, really, in Ann Arbor, Michigan,
mm-hmm.
and.
So it was the cheese itself caught your attention?
Yeah, the cheese itself did at Aaron's Deli in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And Ari Weinzweig was the man who at Zingerman's would sort of go out and travel the world and bring back these amazing products.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought back this cheese called Paramo de Guzman.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a cheap milk cheese. It was made up in the high plains of Spain, and it was really sort of what had once been sort of a house cheese. Really, people made it. Everybody had a slightly different recipe, and this one family had their own recipe, and they decided that they were going to start making this cheese again after many years of not making it.
Mm-hmm.
And it caught Ari's attention. I think he had a piece of it in London at a cheese fair.
Uh-huh.
Just blown away by it. So he brought it back to Zingerman's to sell to his clients. I was looking for work. I had no money, and I went to the deli, and they had me proofreading Ari's newsletter,
mm-hmm.
where he would tell these stories of all his adventures and sort of tracking down all these amazing foods from all over the world. And he had written, I don't know, maybe four paragraphs of a piece of cheese, and it sounded really like the beginning of a fairy tale.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. And you loved the taste also?
I'm sorry?
You loved the taste of the cheese also?
The taste of the cheese. Yeah, I mean, I had occasion cheese at that time. It was a very strong... cheese. I mean, a very strong cheese. It was this sort of cheese that you you know, you really can't oftentimes get to the third bite. You know, it's just that strong. But it was also, you know, it's sort of this mix between I guess it's consistent. It was sort of like a Manchego like way about it, you know. That would be not in taste, but just in sort of texture and density. Mm-hmm. It was more on the Manchego line, but yeah, the way Ari sort of unraveled the story briefly in that little entry was that there had been this family, the Molinas family, that had made this cheese for you know, centuries out in the countryside to mostly feed their field hands. Mm-hmm. So the landowners who had the best food oftentimes had the best workers, and so it was really important that you had both great cheese, great wine, and the Molinas family sort of excelled in the making of cheese and wine. And at some point, all these farms became mechanized, and all the workers went to the cities to work in the factories, and they didn't have a reason anymore to make the cheese. So I think they stopped making the cheese somewhere, you know, in the early 60s. And Ambrosio, the son of Ambrosio Sr., mm-hmm. Decided that he was going to try to make this cheese again. There was no recipe for it.
Mm-hmm.
All the matriarchs sort of knew by, you know, almost like genetic bequeathment how to make this cheese.
Of recipes.
And so his mom helped him try to recover that recipe. And they worked at it for a while. I mean, I think it was actually like a couple of years before they got it right.
Mm-hmm. Now, what year did you taste the cheese at first? And by what time do you go to Spain looking for the family?
Well, so I didn't taste the cheese. This was 1991 when I was at Zingerman's Deli in Ann Arbor. And I was in Spain in the year 2000 to profile Ferran Adrià, the
uh-huh.
chef,
uh-huh.
At El Bulli.
Okay.
And I was there for 10 days or so, and I had a Sunday off. And I had always carried this little clipping from that newsletter ages ago that struck me as sort of incredible, this man making this cheese and aging it in his family cave, sort of hand milking the sheep himself. It was just this strange tale of just one man against sort of the universe making this beautiful cheese. And when people tried this cheese, they said it was full of memories, because people then sort of remembered their mother's kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
So move people, you know, that was the interesting part of it for me, at least, that it moved people. And that it was also the most expensive cheese Zingerman's had ever sold, because Ambrosio said in the newsletter that he put all of his quote unquote love into it. And I thought, you know, that's sort of preposterous to me on some level.
Uh-huh.
But then also intriguing on another level. You know, I just was like, I wonder what that is really about. You know, what is this story about? What is this cheese really about? What does it symbolize
mm-hmm.
for him? So to get to your question, I went and saw Ambrosio for the first time in the year 2000.
Okay.
And he took me in August of 2000 into what was called a telling room, his telling room, which is his family cave.
Mm-hmm.
And in the cave complex, there's a cave down underneath, and then above there's a little room. And that little room, which is made of limestone and usually buried into the hills to the north of town, there might be a wood plank table, a fireplace, a bunch of buttons that they cook the lamb on. It's a very, very earthen, rustic place where they go to eat
uh-huh.
and to tell their stories and to share their dreams.
Did they call it the telling room? Did they call it the telling room?
They did.
Okay. Wait, I'm losing you.
I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Yeah, that was one of the things that they called it. They had several names for it, but the telling room was one of the they would say, let's go up to the telling room. Mm-hmm. And usually it was in the telling room where people really did tell their most important stories. So there was this important aspect of storytelling to the consumption of food. And all of it felt very ancient mm-hmm. and ritualistic. To me, that very first time, I was just really blown away. And Ambrosio himself is just a master storyteller. Uh-huh. So I was very much under his spell.
In 2000, they're not making the cheese anymore, correct?
Well, yeah, and I didn't...
Did you know that when you were setting out on your journey?
No, I didn't. Well, I didn't know that he wasn't making it. Yeah, I knew. I knew that that he had been making it. I knew that he was going to. He had invited me to the village, but I didn't know exactly what we were going to find there.
Uh-huh.
And of course, I was going because I hadn't tried it all those years earlier. It really truly had been too expensive for me to afford. And so I thought this would be amazing to go to this little tiny village of 80 people,
mm-hmm.
This sort of dying village, a half a mile above sea level in this harsh landscape, this harsh Castilian landscape of vineyards and sunflower fields. And when I got there, my friend Carlos and I, Carlos was in translate for me, we went looking for Ambrosio and were pointed to his cave and knocked on the door. And so he came out of the telling room and ushered us in. And we were there probably for about 8 hours, and during which he told this story about this cheese we'd come to try and the fact that he didn't have any of this cheese anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And what he told us was that the cheese had become world famous, and of course, all of this does in the end check out. It's all true, but the cheese when he first made it was something he gave to people in the village, and they passed it to people in the next village over. And people thought it was so good they just kept passing it along, until one day a cheesemonger came up from Madrid and he tried this cheese, and then he brought it to Madrid to sell. And it was said that the king and queen of Spain tried this cheese, and thought it was amazing, and then started to give it as a gift to the royal family of England.
Oh, and so it was getting around.
Yeah, it got around. It did, and was given as a gift to, like, Ronald Reagan. And Fidel Castro tried to buy mm-hmm. all of Ambrosio's cheese. So it was really, there was something about it.
It also came in a tin, which made it even easier to give, you know, to people far away.
Exactly. It was so idiosyncratic, right down to the packaging,
mm-hmm.
That I think people just kind of fell in love with this sort of completely eccentric
mm-hmm.
Product. And then, besides the sort of mythology of it, that if you were to eat this cheese, you were going to have these memories and have this taste experience that was going to overwhelm you on some level.
Mm-hmm.
So Ambrosio then... got to a point where he, as the maker, and he sort of very much sees himself as this sort of bohemian storytelling Falstaff of the fields.
Mm-hmm.
All he wanted to do was make this cheese. He wasn't a great businessman, but as the cheese was more and more in demand, he called in his best friend, a guy named Julian, who was a lawyer and was a great businessman. And so Julian started helping just to advise him mm-hmm. on how to proceed. And Ambrosio wanted to move his whole operation. At the time, it was just he was making the cheese in a stable in the village across from the house where he'd been born. And he wanted to move across the fields to this old factory, this old building that was literally from like the 16th century. I mean, they were going to retrofit it, and they did this. Somewhere along the line, though, as Ambrosio had it, Julian would put these contracts in front of him, and because Ambrosio trusted him like a brother, he would sign them and then go back to making the cheese And Ambrosio then claimed that at some point at the height of the cheese's popularity, he had put his signature on a contract that basically signed away his rights to this cheese, that he'd been bamboozled
by his best friend.
Julian.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then once he realized this, he started to plot the murder of Julian.
Okay, well, it's time
for... That's where I take the twist.
Okay, well, that's we'll get to the murder plot after the break. It's time for us to take a short break on Cutting the Curd. I'll be right back. Thank you, Michael Paternity.
Today's program has been brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm.
Spanning the rolling hills of Vermont's Champlain Valley and easternmost Washington County, New York, 300-acre Consider Bardwell Farm was the first cheese-making co-op in Vermont, founded in 1864 by Consider Stebbins Bardwell himself. Rotational grazing on pesticide-free and fertilizer-free pastures produces the sweetest milk and the tastiest cheese. All of their cheeses are aged on the farm in their extensive system of caves.
Consider Bardwell Farm is also a big supporter of Heritage Foods USA's No Goat Left Behind program. No Goat Left Behind is a serious effort launched in 2011 by Heritage Foods USA, designed to introduce goat meat to American diners and provide a sustainable end market for dairy animals.
For more information, please visit www.considerbardwellfarm.com.
Hi, it's Diane Stemple, Cutting the Curd. We're with Michael Paternity, talking about the book, The Telling Room. Michael, through the book's about you, too.
Yes.
Through the whole book, I'm amazed by your supportive wife. Is it that you are both, as journalists, always traveling for work, so it's not unusual how supportive she is?
Well, maybe she gets what it is that I'm trying to do because she's trying to do it also. But no, she's incredible, and she was completely willing to kind of dive into this adventure.
Right. Because what I want to tell the listeners is, just when I'm thinking your wife must be ready to kill you, you come up with this plan to go live there for a while. With a one,
exactly.
With a 1 and a 3-year-old, correct?
Yes. The one. Yeah.
What was that like? Up there, you go again. Come back.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
I mean, it was probably, you know, not the kind of place where you go if you're looking for playgrounds and all sorts of stuff for 1 and 3-year-olds, because there was really nothing there. There's no Starbucks. There's nothing.
Is there even a store?
I'm sorry?
Is there a store?
No, not in the village. There was a bakery. There was a couple that made bread.
Okay.
Sometimes you could go in and buy your bread, but otherwise there was a bar, which was the center of social life. So you can get your beer and your wine and your hard liquor. But after that, you have to drive for groceries. Most of 3 minutes away. You're really out there. You're shipwrecked.
Right.
In the middle of nowhere.
In Spain.
In Spain, yeah. I mean, I've had this feeling before. Sometimes you drive through some drugs village and you think...
Wait, we're losing you again. Can you get in a better situation?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Try again.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I think sometimes when you're traveling, you'll pass through maybe a very lonely place, and you will, you know, maybe pass through a village and just wonder what it would be like to live there. And this really was sort of that experiment, slowing everything way, way down, and living kind of the old way, really the old Castilian way, and spending time in the fields, going to the telling room and spending nights where people just told old stories, you know, cooked food the old way, all of those things. So that was, you know, I think my wife, to answer your question, was really also excited and ensorcelled by this idea of seeing what it might be like there. And see, and really we were going sort of on this adventure backwards in time, and I think that was intriguing to her. I mean, I think she wished that I would have been more of a reporter and less of a disciple of D'Ambrosio's, because a lot of time passed.
Yes.
We were sort of drinking a lot of wine and talking about Jesus a lot, but not really getting anywhere with it.
At one point, what do you say? 1,000 sips or 1,000 words, and then I can have some more sips?
It was really I was motivated, right, only because it was more time in the telling room. And that was that was fantastic. It was great to live that way for a while. It's not a great way to try to write a book in the end. But
apparently. Has any other story captured you the way D'Ambrosio's story has?
Oh, I think, you know, my life as a journalist, I've been in places that have been more sort of intense and situations that have been, you know, on occasion traumatic and war zones or covering natural disasters. So there was really something about this that, I mean, maybe it just hit me because my other work seems so intense, and the pace of life in this place, and some of the deeper truths that emerged, felt equal to and as important as the other work I was doing. And yet calamity wasn't right in front of your eyes. A deeper, kind of slower unfolding,
right?
The way sort of real life is and its way, and then the all of this was punctuated by eating beautiful food, you know, eating the best possible cheese that one person thought he could make. And so, you know, he had lost the cheese, but he had two and eventually just one tin of it left in his cave. And as an offering to me for the effort that he saw me making to understand his way of life, He did it at one point, share that cheese with me.
In the book, he's larger than life, D'Ambrosio. How many years go by till you meet the lawyer and then Julian?
Oh, God, yeah, probably six years or let go by.
So you were able to kind of keep the fantasy of D'Ambrosio until you meet the lawyer.
Yes, it was really important for me to do that. I mean, at the beginning, I really thought that I was in the middle of a murder plot. You know, I really thought about going, whether I should go to the police, or I was completely swept up in it.
And stop the murder?
I don't know. I was sure.
Well, you didn't want D'Ambrosio to go to jail.
Well, I know, but at the very beginning, I remember saying to Carlos, after we'd been told this story, and he told us how he was going to murder Julian, it was very horrific. And I remember saying to Carlos,
Wait, I lost you. What was Carlos's reaction?
Ask Carlos. Does that make us an accomplice here? He does it. You know, tonight, what happens? Like, we knew about this murder plot, but what I realized, and going back again and again, is that everybody knew that D'Ambrosio, this plan to murder Julian,
and it hadn't happened yet.
It didn't happen, and it kept not happening. It was very bad, and it did. And another story, you know. So for me, then it became intriguing. Like every time he told the story, he was killing Julian in his mind,
right?
And he killed him. You know, he killed him 1,000 times over,
right?
I mean, and then I started thinking about, so what is really happening here? What is the nature of this kind of storytelling?
Mm-hmm. To me, what is most interesting is how difficult it seems to have been for you to integrate the slowly uncovered truth about the failure of the cheese company.
Yeah, well, I do think had I been out on a magazine assignment and I had 5 days to tell this story, I would have gone to Imbruglia, and then, you know, the next day I would have been in Julian's office.
Right, right.
I didn't go there to write it as a book. I didn't go there to write it as an article. I went there to just try some cheese because I love cheese, and I also, this was mythical to me.
Mm-hmm.
And inside of this piece of cheese, you had this, you know, artistry and this story and this history. And so all of it was in this beauty, all of it was in there.
Mm-hmm.
And this very old way of living. So when you were tasting this cheese, you were tasting the land.
Right.
In the very particular terroir of the place. And mm-hmm. So, you know, it was much bigger than that right from the start for me. I went in doing this for myself, not sort of taking a skeptical view of it mm-hmm. as one might as a journalist, but I just went in open-minded and open-hearted, and I got sucked in.
Mm-hmm. I had the thought initially, I had thought that the book was fiction because it was mislabeled on one of the sites when I was investigating. Did you consider changing it to fiction so you could have kept Ambrosio mythical?
Yeah, I think at one point I was wondering and waiting for something to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought this would be so much easier if it was a novel at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like it. It felt like it from the start. It was sort of, it had this magical realist quality anyway. But what I love is this form, this interesting form that sort of is called literary nonfiction or long form. I love working in that space between sort of fiction and nonfiction where mm-hmm. you're employing narrative device and creating a voice for your story and stylizing that story in a way mm-hmm. that it can be read as
right.
novelistic.
Right, right. Well, his story feels very novelistic, and then your story is sort of in between it.
Yeah, exactly. Mine is more sort of straighter memoir.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things in the book is that Ambrosio has this way of telling a story that's very Castilian, with full of footnotes and all sorts of, marginalia. So you don't ever quite get to the story. You know, years can pass before you hear the actual story. Or
right.
someone will tell the story and then someone will immediately contradict it. So there's this interesting tension in the telling of stories. And often the story that they're telling inside of the story or the story that they're sort of pausing to tell you as they're telling the main story is really telling you everything about the story they're trying to tell you. So it became very tricky, and it became this sort of this story full of trap doors. And I wanted to include that until the point at which I took control of the story again.
Mm-hmm.
And so the last third of the book, then, you know, there are less footnotes. And
right, you're swept back up into the story in that part. Now, the
exactly.
footnotes, I do have a few questions. Did your editors complain about the footnotes? There are lots of footnotes.
Yeah, no. It's funny. In fact, if anything, my editor, really encouraged it because he just felt like, I know this is going to be difficult for some people, but, like, I know what you're trying to do here, you know? And
uh-huh.
why don't we, if we're going to do it, let's play with it, you know, why? Well, I kind of do just a little, like, why don't you reflect it as accurately as you, like, the way those interruptions mm-hmm. occur and frustrate. In some ways, it is until you get swept into this other story within a story, which is also magical and mystical and completely compelling.
Mm-hmm. Are you generally a footnote user? Did your other book have footnotes?
God. No, not at all. I don't. I've not, you know, partial to them.
Also, are they footnotes mostly factual? If you had to, I mean, how do you decide when to put something in a footnote?
We have a lot of conversation about that, and able to read the book without footnotes.
Mm-hmm.
So if the story held together above the footnotes, that was fine with me. And then if you wanted to go down into the cave underneath and you wanted to really get down in there and the timeless place closer to the center of the earth, there it was.
Right, it'd be interesting to go through and just read the footnotes.
And down there's all that that I think deepens the story, but if you can still, I hope, be very entertaining about the book.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take you to decide the organization of the book?
Well, I did write that book, beginning of that. Probably wrote it and rewrote it 4 or 5 times, up to like page 150 or 160.
Uh-huh.
And then I would always stop at the end of the summer,
right,
when we left Guzman.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't want to leave that place. I didn't really want to ask the questions that I needed to ask.
What really happened?
Julian, and what really happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and then when I finally worked up the gumption, started to really get to the middle of it, that pretty quickly, and just as it is reflected in the book.
Mm-hmm. Will Ambrosio read the book?
Yeah, I was in London doing a book, some book stuff, and he came up for us. We did a big event together, which was wonderful.
Oh,
and he's very good friends with Monica Linton, who runs this sort of series of Spanish tapas restaurants in
mm-hmm.
London.
Mm-hmm.
So she was also, we did the event at one of her places. And he's not, I don't know that he's ever going to finish a book, period. He's just too distracted to do that.
Right.
And his whole life is about oral storytelling.
Right.
But I do think that he understands that in the end I had to sort of tell my own truth. And he's been really, really supportive of that from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
He at some point, as I was struggling to write this thing, he said, I do understand that you have a job to do. I know you're going to have to ask certain questions and you're research and, just tell the truth as best you can.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounded good at the time. This is a man who said he was going to murder his best friend. So I sort of had this thing in the back of my mind, like, if I screw this up, .. he may have the next plot for me. So far, it's okay.
So far, it looks good. Well, thank you very much for coming on our show, Cutting the Curd. You have a lot of cheese listeners who will be, reading your book or already have read your book. I didn't want to give too much away during the interview.
Well,
and
sure. Thank you, Diana.
You're very welcome. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to Jack Inslee, engineer, for today's show. I'll be back with another cheese book next month. And this is Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd. Thanks.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat & 3 is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah. And my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.